Welcome to the Learn My Craft podcast. Today I am joined by the lovely Emma Colbert. So Emma is a leading pastel artist known for her vibrant, detailed animal portraits and wildlife paintings. Her partnership with Unison Colorsoft Pastels led to the creation of pastel sets made specifically for animal portraits. Emma's work has appeared on the cover of Artists and Illustrators magazine, and she teaches thousands of artists worldwide through her YouTube channel and her Patreon. I first discovered Emma's work early on in my own pet portrait journey, and I've been inspired ever since. So Emma, welcome to the Learn My Craft podcast. Thank you for coming in today.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for the invitation and for the lovely introduction as well. I really appreciate it.
But I do love the vibrancy that you can get with some of the pastels, isn't it? It's just so, it's so cool the way when you put it on the page, it's just like, wow, that's cool.
Yeah, it really, out of all the mediums, that's what really draws me to soft pastel, because you can feel like you're painting. You can, you know, you can put pigment on in a way that feels very much like oil paint, only it's not wet. Mm-hmm. But in actual fact, the way the dryness of soft pastel works, it's even, to me, it's even nicer than oil painting, because all of those little dry pigments and bits of crystal, they all kind of sit on the paper at different angles. So this is why a lot of the papers are quite textured, and it allows the pigment to sit in all of these different ways that it catches the light so beautifully. Because even with an oil painting, for example, when you add that final layer of varnish, quite a lot of the time then you get like a bit of glare from the painting, or the end result always looks quite flat to me, whereas there's something extra magical about pastel painting up close. You really get to see the true vibrance of it, and yeah, I think that's due to how the crystals all sit on the paper. So yeah, it feels magical to me.
Yeah. I also think, I feel like pastels are really easy to photograph and present well because of the sort of matteness of it as well.
Yeah. This is another nice thing. I actually scan a lot of my work, and it scans very well too. So you can take, because you're working on paper most of the time, you can take this and actually physically put it inside a scanner. Doesn't come to any harm. I might have to wipe the glass a little bit afterwards, but I find that they photograph well and they scan well. It's quite a good medium to make digital versions of your work from.
Oh, fantastic. That's really good then. So what surfaces do you use most then? Is it like pastel paper or like a board? And do you have to adapt your technique for each different surface?
Well, in the early days, in the very earliest days of me starting to do any commissioned pet portraits, I was actually using really cheap, thin, basic pastel paper that you would use as a student, perhaps. The Ingres paper, it's like quite a rough surface. It can produce some lovely effects. I still see artists use this paper very well. But the way that I want to work, by layering up lots of pigment and manipulating the pigment on the paper, this thinner paper doesn't really, you know, you hit the wall very quickly and you fill the tooth of the paper and you can't add any more, or you can't add details. So the first proper thick pastel paper that I discovered was Hanamule Velour. This was the first paper that I actually bumped into another artist called Vic Beercroft. I don't know if you've heard of him, a fantastic wildlife artist. And he was in the Eddie C Centre in Birmingham, actually, sitting with his whole stall. And he was sitting there working on a wolf on Hanamule Velour paper. And this was me just completely sold. I asked him everything. Tell me what this is. How are you doing this? And he's a very generous artist. And he told me all about this paper. And honestly, for the next 10 years, this is the only paper that I used for all of my commissions, for landscape, wildlife, everything. I really grew to love this paper a lot. And then I think, again, it's because of teaching that I started to diversify, because I started to get asked a lot about other papers that I didn't really know much about. And so I started to experiment on different papers. The first one really that I took to would be Clairefontaine-Pastelmatt, which is such a popular paper. I think even in colored pencil world, this is a paper that a lot of artists use, and I can totally see why. I love it as well. And then since then, I've tried a lot of sanded papers. So like UART, Fischer 400 is probably my favorite of the really sandpaper-like papers. Archival as well is quite similar. And then more recently, the Kansan Mi-Tint Velvet paper. And I've really started to use it a lot. So every time they bring out more papers, I'm keen to try them now. So I'm always happy to find alternative materials that I don't feel stuck with one set of materials anymore. I really feel like I've got all of this choice, and I can just decide painting by painting which one I think would be best for this job, or which one I'm in the mood for. It's so nice to have such a selection of materials.
Yeah, I totally get what you mean because I chose a paper and basically stuck with it for 6 years. And it wasn't until I started teaching again, I didn't try out different things and diversify. And now I do feel like, oh, I'm drawing this, it will probably work better on that paper, or I'm drawing this, it will work better on that paper. And you sort of like build up this knowledge, don't you, by actually trying different pieces of paper.
Exactly. I think that's the best way to learn anything, really. It's just to try as much as you possibly can. And of course, a lot of the papers, they can be very pricey. Some of the, especially some of the more coated papers that I've just been naming, they're not cheap. So it is nice if you can buy like an individual sheet rather than a big pad, with lots of it. It's nice if you can get some little samples or buy individual sheets of papers, because I mean, for some people, certain papers that I love, other artists will absolutely hate this paper. It really is like a personal choice. And I think you do have to kind of alter your technique maybe a little bit from paper to paper, as I'm sure you do as well with the different papers you use. But on the whole, you're going about things in a similar manner. It's the little things that perhaps you've got to adjust how much you blend on this paper, or how many layers you can put down on this paper. There are little things that do change.
Yeah, definitely. No, I find that as well. So, besides pastels and paper, what other tools do you use to create your work? Like, what blending tools or any brushes or fixatives do you use?
Well, blending, I really like blending, even though for some pastel artists, there are many pastel artists who never ever blend. And this is, I would say, if you're working in a looser, more expressive style, you may not need any blenders at all. But in my work, especially when I'm creating more like realistic portraits or things like that, I do blend a lot. I love to mix the pigments when they're on the paper. So I actually really love I think they come along with the Pan Pastels, or they're a brand connected to the Pan Pastels, the Soft Tools. And that's soft with two Fs. You know about these already, and
Yeah, I use those as
I
well.
really like these tools. I mean, there are things that if you can't get hold of those, there are things that you probably have in your house. Especially if you wear makeup or things like this, there's probably things that you have that would do a similar job. Or you could buy like little sponges and cut them into shapes. You could find things that do a similar job. But for me, the soft tools, because they have the nice handle, so they're very nice to hold, very comfortable to use. And my favorite one is the little triangular shaped one. Yeah, so it's got the palette knife handle, and then you've got the little triangular sponge, which you can change then for clean ones. And this one, this is probably the only blender I use at the moment. I absolutely love this one. In terms of
Same.
any
I
other,
only use that one.
you use that one too? Okay.
Yeah.
It's just got such a nice point on it, and you know, when your fingertip is just to blunt an instrument to blend something, you can get such a soft edge with things. You can soften edges. You can blend with some precision with that tool, which I really like. And then sometimes as well, if you've actually put down a lot of layers of pigment, starting from dark to light, you can go back and almost paint with this tool. So you don't need to put, I very rarely put any pigment on the soft tool before I apply it. A lot of the time I'm using the pigment that's already on the piece, and you can kind of like remove the lighter layers in places and like paint back into your work. So yeah, this blending tool, this is my favorite as well.
Oh, very cool.
But in terms of other tools, not so much. I don't use fixative. I did in the earlier years, when I was working on the Hanamule velour paper. I would spray some fixative on the lower layers. So as I'm building up the darker layers, I would spray it sort of in between layers, and then not so much on the final layers, because I've always found that it kind of darkens the whole thing. You kind of lose the vibrance of it. So as I've progressed though onto other papers like pastel matte, well, all of the other papers really, I just don't really find that they need fixative. A pastel painting just needs to go behind glass, really. That's kind of the best way to protect the piece for life. Or if I'm just storing them, then I put them inside, like inside sheets of paper or glassine, and inside big art folders that I have. So yeah, just never use fixative anymore.
That's very interesting because you'd think that you would need to use fixative, especially for pastel work, to make sure that, your whole drawing doesn't fall off. But does it like cure at all, like over time and like stop, I guess, coming off the paper?
Well, to be honest, I just don't find that it comes off these papers. The more modern papers, with the earlier paper that I was using, the one that I mentioned, like the student grade kind of papers that I was using, yes, pigment fell off those. And sometimes with the velour paper, actually, if I overpainted, so like in the early days, if I really overworked something, and I added too much pigment, then I could have a problem when it came to framing. For example, if the framed piece got like a hard knock or something, then sometimes a bit of pastel dust might hit the glass on the inside, or fall, even worse, fall on the mount, or on the mat at the bottom. So yeah, I have encountered some problems. But with the papers that I use in general, I just don't get any pastel fall off. I mean, at the end of a painting, I will take the piece outside and like shake it around, like literally hit it a good bang on the back. And if there's anything loose there, it'll come off in this moment. But after that, they're not going anywhere. And I have had pastel paintings from more than 20 years ago, and they're exactly the same as they were when I painted them. So it's definitely a
That's
medium that
fantastic.
has longevity. If you're using archival quality materials, so that they don't fade, that's like the main thing that you want, to choose materials that are light fast and that they don't fade and change color over time. But in general, pastel pigment won't fall off the paper over time, which is good to know.
Yes, that is really good to know because I always sort of thought, because I don't really use much pastel, only a little bit for my backgrounds, and then I fill it with colour pencil, so I don't really have that issue anyway. But it's very good to know that it won't actually fall off if you're using the right paper and things, and as long as you beat it like a rug, I guess.
Yeah. Well, that's just one way. You know, some people will also like put it between some sheets of paper and press it. You can also do this. That's quite a good idea, you know, and just you're really like pressing all of the loose pigment perhaps into the paper. But I also find that because I blend a lot, especially in my backgrounds, so I do I like to use the soft sticks in the backgrounds and then do lots of rubbing and lots of blending. And that pigment for sure isn't going anywhere because it's been like scrubbed into the texture of the paper, and it's yeah, there's no loose pigment sitting there, so yeah.
Oh, that's very cool. Very useful to know. So, because pasta is like notoriously known for being quite a messy medium, really, getting it everywhere, how do you keep your materials clean and organized as you work?
I'm usually the messiest thing in my studio. I'm reasonably good and reasonably organized at keeping my space quite tidy. I wouldn't say it's 100% clean. It probably doesn't come out on camera, but there is usually a good deal of dust around. It is advisable to work like next to an open window or somewhere where you have good ventilation so that you're not breathing in too much airborne pigment. But again, in the way that I work, I apply the layers of pigment quite thinly, so I'm not leaning really heavily and I'm not creating a dust storm, if you like, while I'm working. There's really very little pigment that is airborne while I'm working. And so I don't really feel like I'm at risk from breathing it in or I think it just depends on your style of working. I'm sure that some people possibly do create a bit of a dust storm. I can imagine if you're working on one of the really rough sanded papers and you like to work big, then perhaps this is going to be dustier in your studio. And apart from that, I wash my hands regularly. It's so easy to wash off everything because I always find with oil paint, I am an absolute mess and there's no cleaning it off either. So I'm a mess for days after I oil paint. Whereas with soft pastel, it's so easy to clean up. If you drop it somewhere, if it's all over your light switches or your door handles, everything, it's so easy to clean it up. And then in terms of my actual pastels, they're always, by the end of a painting, my entire tray of pastels that I've been using, they're probably all close to a brown color because they've all got mixed and my dirty fingerprints all over them. So just when I finish a painting, then I just take usually some squares of toilet roll and I just give each one a little rub and put it back in its place. And that's all it really requires, just to keep on top of it and to keep the main palette of colors nice and clean at least. So
Oh,
yeah,
that's a
I'm
really
not
good
a very
idea.
clean or tidy person, but I don't find it too difficult to keep on top of it.
Yes, as long as you clean up after you finish the drawing, then everything is fine.
Yeah, I think that's the main idea. Keep it under control as you go.
Do you wear gloves at all?
I don't know. I really enjoy the hands-on feeling. I know a lot of artists do wear the gloves when they're using pastel. And I know that a lot of people love to use this medium but actually hate the feeling of it, which I can understand that. If you've got like a bit of an aversion to the dry, kind of chalky feel all over your hands. But for me, I quite like it. I quite like the mess of it. And I quite like, well, I'm not so keen on it underneath all of my fingernails. That's probably not so great. But I don't really mind. Yeah. For me, it's an added part of the fun, you know.
Yes, definitely. I think probably the hard part is making sure you don't put fingerprints all over your work as you're trying to do it.
Yeah, for sure. And there are ways that I try to avoid doing that as well. So I was working on a little girl's portrait this last week, and I purposefully left like the strip of hair down here. I didn't put any pigment there because I was like using my little finger to just like lean on that place while I was doing little details, in her eyes, or and I would just like kind of anchoring myself using my fingertip. And then, I can just put pigment all over that when I'm ready to. So I will use an area of the paper to kind of lean on, or some area that I haven't worked yet usually gets leaned on a little bit.
No, that's a really clever idea, like specifically leaving an area of your work to come to after you've done certain details. Like, yeah, that's definitely good for people to know.
Or you could like also stick like a sheet of paper, you know, over half of your work, and then you've got a whole place to like lean your hand on. I think because I'm filming a lot, I don't really like to cover half the painting. It kind of ruins
That's the problem.
It ruins the footage a little bit, but perhaps if I was just working in my studio by myself with no camera going, this might be something I would do more often.
Yeah, definitely. Now, I used to cover my paper as well, but now that we have to film everything, for social media or for teaching, whatever you're doing, you can't really do that anymore. But I like your idea of leaving a space to anchor yourself. Like, that's a really good one.
Yeah.
So do you ever use toned paper or alcohol washes?
Well, most of the papers I use are toned. So the odd time I will be using a paper that is kind of white or cream. That would be the Fisher 400 because it only comes in that color. And I do like this paper, so it doesn't bother me if the paper is white to begin with. But the majority of the time, I like to use a mid-tone color of paper. So it'll be, in fact, a warm mid-tone color of paper has become my preference more recently, rather than gray tones and, you know, the cooler tones. A lot of the time I'm using like a sandy color or like a light brown, something like that. I really like to start from this kind of mid-tone. And then occasionally, like recently, I've been using some black papers to do some nighttime studies. And again, my teaching pushing me out of comfort zones and getting me to try different things. So I love to use a toned paper, and the alcohol wash isn't actually something I have tried yet, but it is on my to-do list. It will be a thing that I do try at some point. Because I also like the idea of, I know that some artists go for like a really hot pink or, you know, a color that you can't buy in a paper brand, but then you can just choose whatever color you want as your base color and add a wash of this. So this is definitely something I would like to try. I've seen a lot of fantastic artists use this method. So yeah, it's on my to-do list for sure.
Yeah, it sounds like it'd be quite fun to try out really like extreme colours and different ways of layering, I suppose, as well.
Yeah, I think sometimes if you're going to do this, like make use of a really vibrant tone of paper, it's nice to use a style that lets some little bits of paper show through in the end. This is also nice. And it's not usually the way I work. The way I work, I'm usually really covering the paper, like with multiple layers. So I think the more I branch out into like looser landscape styles, the tone of the paper underneath becomes even more interesting to me. So I'm getting there. I think this is something I'll try soon.
Oh, very interesting. I also find it interesting that you're liking the warmer tone, because I found warmer tones quite difficult to use in contrast to like cooler tones. So how has that sort of like changed your process in terms of like color picking and layering if you're starting off with a warm toned paper?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I used to use quite a lot of gray tones. Certainly with the Hanamule velour paper in the earlier days, I would buy equal amounts of the sand color, and there I think it's like a light gray, and I would basically look at my reference image before starting, and if I was getting more warmth from the reference image, then I would go with the warm tone. Or if it was like literally a cat with a lot of gray tones, like a gray tabby, then I would go with the gray tone. You know, I would try to choose the paper that was going to be helpful with the subject matter that I'm painting. But I think over time, I think I just prefer the warmth that shines through from using a warm toned paper, because even though I cover all of the paper, I still feel like it has some impact on the final effect, that you still get, you still get a little bit of a sense of what's underneath. And I think I really have a preference for painting things extra warm. And I recently thought that maybe that's because I wear sunglasses a lot of the time when I'm outside, you know, because I always have the rose-tinted view of things. And so that might actually affect my color choices when I'm painting, I'm thinking, because I just like to warm things up. I really like to add heat to everything. So maybe this is part of the reason why. So I'm not sure why I have gravitated towards that, to be honest.
No, it's very cool. I love colour choices. That's why I don't really like using colour picking tools, because I feel like your colour choices is what makes it unique to your style of working, and everybody will see things differently. They'll see more blues or more greens or more yellows, and I really love that, because you could have, you know, 10 different artists drawing the same piece, but everybody will see the colour very differently. And so I love not using colour picking tools specifically, because I think it's better when you just look at it, because I feel like even your mood can change what colors you see as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure it does. And what you say there is interesting about the color picker. To me, this tool is very useful in terms of pointing out tonal value rather than what color exactly it is. To me, I don't actually use a color picker, because again, I also really enjoy the choosing of the colors and the seeing what you can try to bring out more. But for anybody learning and for anybody struggling to pick colors, something I always say is that a color picker tool is very useful at pointing out when you're going to light with something, because that's usually the common mistake that we all make. We choose a color that's a bit too light in tonal value rather than something that is actually dark enough. And I see that with so many of my students as well. And I made exactly the same mistakes all along the way. And I think the color picker is very good sometimes to just show you an isolated color. And what used to really surprise me was, oh, wow, it's much darker than I would have imagined. You know, like if you're color picking on a white T-shirt and you're expecting it to be a color that's close to white and it comes out like dark, muddy, blue, gray, or brown, you know, to me, this is such a great way to help you see color better, to isolate color and to trust what your eyes are actually seeing as opposed to what you believe it should be, you know. So it has a good usage, I think, and it's mostly in terms of tonal value, I think, at pointing out where you need to go darker or lighter. But yeah, I agree. The color choices that an artist makes are so individual. You know, everyone will choose something different, and that's the great thing.
Definitely. No, I like your idea of using it as a tonal value, picking the tonal value rather than trying to mix to that color. I think I'm definitely going to use that idea. It sounds really good.
Well, you can also compare your, you know, you can take a progress picture of your piece and change that into grayscale and then compare it with the photo reference also in grayscale. This is also something that I recommend all the time, because if your tonal values are off, I feel like it's the number one important thing, because if you get the tonal values pretty close, you can go wild with the colors. Like you can heat something up, you can cool it down, you can really add your own stamp on the color choices. But the main basis of it all, I feel, is the tonal values. So even just grayscaling either your finished work, or if you're a bit stuck halfway through, take a progress picture, change it into grayscale, compare it with the photo reference in grayscale. It can point out a whole world of things and places where you're going just slightly off.
No, that's very good advice. Thank you. Very interesting. I'm definitely going to try and do that, because there are a few times, you know, when you do get stuck, you think, well, is it finished? It sort of looks all right. It looks good enough, I suppose, but there's like something off, you know, and you're not really sure what to change. But that's a really good starting point, is to reflect on the values first. Yeah, because I normally do that by eye, but I've never actually scanned it in and changed it to grayscale to look at it first. Yeah, I just do that blurring eyes thing.
Yeah, that's good as well. Squinting is another good thing. Squinting, yeah. Or for me, I always have a mirror hanging like directly behind me, So I always sit on a spinning stool, and while I'm working on something, I will continuously look at it behind me in a mirror, and that just lets
Oh.
me see it from a distance. It lets me see it like flipped as well, which there are certain things that if you're painting, seeing it in reverse can just instantly point out where the mistake is, or but I think the main thing is like getting some distance away from your painting while you're working on it. So the squinting is another brilliant one as well. So yeah, there are lots of ways to try and get a different perspective on your work while you're painting it or while you're drawing it, because I think we all fall victim to getting just too involved in it, too close to the work, and then after a while you actually can't see it at all. You know, it's you really need the fresh eyes to come back and fix whatever it is that needs fixed. Usually requires fresh eyes, I find.
Yeah, definitely. Because you do see things like, because you'll be probably in a different mood or see things in a different light, and that always makes a difference, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
Yeah. So, can you now talk us through your process? Like, how do you layer your colors down, and like, how do you color swatches first, or what kind of thing do you like to do?
Well, I always start with the line drawings, and I tend to prepare those on another sheet of paper, and then I'll transfer that onto my pastel paper. So I really like to start with a good, clean-looking line where I've got all of the proportions figured out pretty close. And then the first thing I usually start with is the background. So I tend to block in large areas on the painting. A lot of the time I'm working basically from background to foreground, and you know, really building things up as they appear within the composition. This is certainly the case with portraiture. I will nearly always work the whole background first, or I'll perhaps leave some things that are in the immediate foreground. So if it's a dog on a soft blanket, for example, maybe I leave the blanket until the very end, you know, if it's right in the front of the picture. And then my basic method is to start with the darks. I always start with the darker tones that I can see. And to me, soft pastel feels very much like oil painting. It's very much the same process. It's actually partly why I refer to my work as paintings, because in my brain, I am painting. It's less to do with something that's wet or dry for me. It's more to do with, am I building things using line and shading, or am I blocking in big areas of color and, you know, building things using shapes rather than lines? So for me, my method really, it rings true with painting more than with drawing. So for me, I use soft pastel very much how I would oil paint. It's like the same method. And from there, from the darks, I just try to then build up the main shapes that I can see. So I try not to get into too much detail to begin with. And I try to build up from the darks through into the midtones, and I usually leave most of the highlights until a bit later in the process. So that's really it in its essence. For me, it's very similar to a lot of oil painters as well.
Oh, that's very interesting. I like your distinction between like line and shading and blocking and putting in the color first. I feel like that's a really nice way of separating paintings from like the painting techniques from non-painting techniques, I guess. It's not necessarily about the medium, it's more about the techniques.
Well, it's a controversial subject in the art world, so I'm
Yeah.
sure we might get some comments with pe from people who disagree with that. But I feel
Maybe.
like the lines are blurred. You know, I feel like you can pick up a paintbrush and load it with a bit of oil paint and produce a line sketch. You know, like, so to me it. To me, the way I think of it is less to do with what the medium actually is, whether it's wet or dry, and more to do with the method or how you approach the piece, you know, because I certainly do drawings as well, but I feel like most of my pastel work is it's a painting method that I'm using, so yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's very interesting. I like that. So how do you avoid overworking or muddying the pastel as you build up the layers?
That's a really good question. And I think in the earlier days, when you're just starting out with soft pastel, this is something that can definitely happen you a lot, because you're still experimenting with how much pigment to apply, how much to mix it and smudge it. And I think just over the years of using soft pastel, this is something that I have gotten better at. And knowing how much pigment to apply to get a certain effect, I feel like I don't often overwork things anymore, especially if it's a subject matter within my comfort zone. So like if it's a dog portrait, for example, I'm much more solid at those these days, and I don't tend to make as many mistakes as I would have done in the earlier days. But then give me a landscape or something that I still struggle with sometimes, or just something that is new to me, I can still overwork. I can still make a bit of a muddy mess sometimes. So yeah, I think it's the more you get comfortable with your chosen subject matter, the less these things will happen, because you've got previous experience to call upon, and it kind of stops you from making those same mistakes again. But yeah, it can still happen. It can still happen.
Yeah, definitely. Now, I find the same thing, because like I predominantly do pets as well. And then I was trying out landscapes, and then I tried fish. And that I found really hard. Like, it was just very tricky. It's unlike the texture I've done before, because you think that, oh, it's just a smooth texture, like a face, like I can do faces. It just seems different somehow. It's like a different, I keep muddying it. It's very annoying.
Well, I imagine with fish, this would be, with the scales and the patterns, this could be tricky. But it's like you say, it's just trying something that you're not comfortable with or that you're not used to. And even sometimes what you describe there, where you think it's going to be absolutely fine, and so you really go for it, to realize, oh, this is not what I thought was going to happen. And then you realize at that point, well, I've added so much pigment now, and I've got to try and correct it, or, you know, so it can happen to anyone.
Start again.
Or this. Yeah. No, this can happen to anyone, and still with like experienced artists like ourselves who've been doing it for a long time, you can still find this happens. So for anyone starting out, it's not something to get really discouraged about, because we all have off days or just subjects that send us a bit, you know. So yeah, it can happen to any of us.
Exactly, yeah. So you said before that you've really enjoyed experimenting with colour now, and you've been doing a lot more different colour choices in your work. So how do you factor in colour theory when you're choosing your palette?
In the earlier days of painting commissions, my work looked very flat in terms of colour. They would look good in terms of the textures that I was creating and the likeness. I could get a good likeness. But to me, something always seemed to be lacking, and I didn't even know what. I didn't know that colour theory was the thing I was missing. I had no clue. And it was actually watching a lot of documentaries, art documentaries and things, because this is before the world of YouTube tutorials and all the information that is out there now. This is back when I graduated in about 2009, maybe, that I'm starting to watch loads of older art documentaries about the Impressionists. And I've also seen quite a lot of the Impressionists' work in different museums and galleries over the years as well. And it's really their work that made me realize that looks more alive, that looks more, even though it's loose and it's not my style, I'm more controlled, I'm more, tight in my style. It was their use of color really that made me think I could try and incorporate a bit of that. What are they doing? Like, why does that work so well? And that led me off into the world of color theory. So I had never really learned much about color theory in school. or in art college. I didn't really get that information, and the whole topic of art theory and being able to then incorporate little bits of that into my work over the years that followed, and then seeing with my own eyes the magic that that actually, it brought my work where I wanted it to go. And that was the whole reason why I started blogging and making videos and things, like the color theory side of things, because I really felt like, well, I went to art college. I didn't study fine art, but I still went to an art college and managed to come out with zero knowledge about color theory. And I just felt like, well, how many people must be struggling with the exact same thing? And this was me thinking about what my 16-year-old self would have wished to hear back then, you know, someone really pointing out the importance of this stuff, but saying it in a way that didn't make it sound overly complicated and scary, you know, more like, if you just take this little bit of information and do that, that's going to change everything for you. So it was just like, how can I share some of the little bits that have been most important in my work and make it sound as simple as it actually is, you know, because it doesn't have to be complicated and you don't need to use it in a really sophisticated way. There are just some basic ideas within color theory that start to change the way you look at color in general. So that's, yeah, it's been a long journey for me figuring out how to, you know, play more with color and how to push my color choices a bit more while still staying within the realms of realism. But it's been the most enjoyable part of my work over the years, exploring all of that. And then soft pastel is just a fantastic medium to explore color in, because you're not mixing paint, you've just got the whole world of color in front of you. Once you start to add to your collection of colors, then it's a very visual way to work with color, I think.
Yeah, definitely. No, that's wonderful. I felt the same way with color theory. Like, I have been able to copy pictures but not really understood color theory or like temperature, even you know, warm shadows, core highlights, or you know, all that kind of stuff. And I haven't really understood that until now, when I started going back and teaching it and trying to teach it, and like, oh, realizing, oh, I actually don't know much about why I'm choosing that color, because I feel like I do a lot of things instinctively but I don't have a good answer why. So going back to research, I realized, oh, I'm doing this and that's a color theory technique. Okay, great.
Yeah, you can reverse engineer things for sure. You realize later on that you're doing something, and then by going back and figuring out why you're doing that, that can open up a whole other world of things that you're not doing already. So yeah, there are many ways to come at the same information and to figure this all out. Yeah,
because now I've become very interested in limited palette studies. So I've just been using three colours to do my drawings now. And that's just been like a huge game changer, I feel like, in terms of colour theory. Because I used to use, you know, I've got all of the pencils I could ever buy, but I don't need to use them anymore because I've learned to use just three colours. And that's just been very insightful. And I feel like I've learned more from doing less, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Just from learning colour.
Yeah. I think the more you learn, the more you realize what you can do without, you know, for a certain effect, you can really, like you're saying about working with a limited palette, there's such a beauty in doing that as well. But if you're working with a limited palette because you feel limited with color, that feels different, but it's nice to make that choice, you know, a deliberate decision to hone in on these colors and see what you can do with that. So yeah, this is where it's great to push yourself out of the comfort zone, as always. And and if color theory is something that people struggle with, I'm always trying to encourage people to just play with some of the ideas. And like, even what you're saying about copying some of their artists, this is so useful as well, because sometimes you wonder why they choose to do this, and that leads you down a path where you know you get to experiment with it yourself and see it work in front of your own eyes. So yeah, all of that's good.
Yeah, fantastic. So you do incredibly beautiful pet portraiture. Like, I feel like your texture is always spot on. What is your approach for creating very fine details and crisp edges with your pastels?
Well, I just find soft pastel really versatile. So we already spoke about pastel pencils. If I do feel the need for some really tiny details, like for example, often around the black shape of an eye on a dog portrait or something, I will absolutely pick up the black pastel pencil. But I think what I enjoy most is creating the illusion of detail where it isn't so detailed as you might think. And to do that with the soft pastel sticks is so effective. So I know that there are many pencil artists who work in a truly detailed, like mind-blowingly detailed way. And I see some of your pet portraits, some of the ones behind you, and I think you really have a love for detail as well, which is amazing. And I think with pencil, this is so possible. If you've got the patience to see it through, you can create mind-blowing detail. And I think for me with soft pastel, I'm trying to find like a balance between there must be detail because I love that too. But then I also like to, where I can be, a little bit more suggestive with the details and with the types of marks that I'm making. For me, it's a lot of fun to see if I can get the effect of the detail without actually rendering every single hair. And you mentioned edges there. Edges are like really important in all sorts of mediums, soft edges and hard edges. And again, with soft pastel, it's such a great medium because I can create a really crisp edge, a hard line. But then I can also choose to soften an edge. I can smudge it and really affect the either it's hard or soft. And right throughout my paintings, there will be like a lot of importance based on the edges of the animal, how they sit against the background, how that makes them come forward in the painting and appear 3D. So yeah, I just find soft pastel extremely versatile for this. Whether it's loose and expressive marks that you want, or really crisp and fine detail. I feel like it's all possible with soft pastel.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I get addicted to the detail as well. I just love doing it. But I guess the trick is to, like you said, do the detail without doing the detail, so it's more of like an illusion of detail. I think that's when you know that you're hitting on something good there with your creativity.
Well, I think it really depends on the medium, to be honest, because I hugely appreciate the work of many pencil artists as well. And this is, it's just notoriously a detailed medium. And I have huge admiration for this. But I also feel like I don't have quite the patience to produce that level of detail. So for me, the soft pastels gives me like an in-between world where I can create detail, but it's not going to take me quite as long because there's so many really detailed artists that I have a lot of admiration for, but I have no idea how they get through the amount of pieces that they do. It's quite it to me it feels like quite a laborious medium to work with when you've only got the tiniest brush to work with for the whole piece. So I think these days a lot of pencil artists are discovering like the pan pastels, like you mentioned, to use something quicker for the big areas of color. And I think that's great when you can combine the materials in this way to speed through some areas of the piece where you can apply, broader marks or bigger amounts of pigment, and then spend all of your time on the really important detailed areas where you want to spend the time. So yeah, I really like the combination of like the pan pastel backgrounds and then all of the detail in the foreground.
Yeah, I like that too. I discovered that about, I guess, 6 years ago now, I think, with the pan pastels and mixing those with coloured pencils, and I just really enjoyed that. That's where I feel like my work, I guess, took a step forward because I was able to not only do it in a quicker process, but it kept the vibrancy. Like I said before, the pastels just gave it a different dimension of depth that you couldn't quite get with the pencils just by themselves.
Yeah, for sure. You kind of get the best of both worlds when you combine things like this. You know, you get the solid, opaque vibrance of the soft pigment, and then the very sharp, fine detail of the pencils. So yeah, it's a good combination. I think that's why it's becoming more and more popular, this method of working.
Yeah, definitely. So I know we slightly talked about this before, but how do you decide when a painting is finished?
Sometimes difficult, and it often depends on the subject matter that I'm painting. So I mentioned that I was working on a human portrait for the past week, and that to me is the hardest thing to decide it's finished. And I'm still not sure that it's finished. I could still go back and see problems, you know, when you're trying to get the likeness of someone. This one I find the hardest of all. With other things, with my pet portraits, I'm much more sure when I'm finished. I feel like I just know I've done everything, and I look back over it and everything's done. In my brain, I can see very easily when I'm done with an animal. And then with landscapes, again, this is one I'm never sure if I'm finished, especially if I'm trying to paint in a slightly looser style than normal. Quite often I get to where I think I'm close to the end, and then I have to like leave it alone for a day, like come back to it, because I get super critical of my landscapes while I'm working on them. And by close to the end, I can absolutely hate it. I can just think, oh, well, this has gone wrong. This is terrible. This is just one of my worst paintings. And then if I leave it alone and I come back the next day, sometimes I'm just like, oh no, it's fine. It just needs this and this and okay, done. And it's such a weird thing for me, because normally I'm quite sure when I've, you know, I've worked through the whole process, I've got the likeness, I've got the softness of a background against the detail in the animal, all of that I'm pretty sure about. But yeah, landscapes and people portraits, these are the, like my two nemesis, I think. And I'm still not sure when I'm finished those.
I guess that will come with practice, won't it? Because you've got so much experience in animal portraiture, probably twice as much as you do in landscapes and people portraiture. So it just comes down to experience. But do you ever do that thing with the human portrait when you turn it upside down and have a look at it again? Because I find that quite helpful for me.
Absolutely, yeah. Like I said earlier about the mirror behind me, behind my desk, this is fantastic for people portraits, especially because, you know, you're saying about flipping it upside down. Well, yeah. I'm just talking about flipping it the other way. I think the idea is to flip it in some way that you get a fresh view of it, you know, and it points out things that you weren't noticing before. So yeah, definitely another useful way, because it makes you, I think, just focus on the overall shapes of things. You're not honing in on small areas. You see it more abstractly, which can be the best way to point out where you've got some issues.
And especially if you're drawing someone you know, I feel like your memory tries to take over, doesn't it? It's like, no, that's not what they actually look like. Just look at the paper.
Yeah, that's very true, because the portrait I was working on this week, it is a family member. And this felt like the worst thing ever, because I not only know her and her family, I'm going to have to see this portrait hanging on their wall for years. And if it's not good, then, you know, it's just torturous to have to see it every time you visit. So, yeah, I felt a lot of pressure to get this person right. Way more stress and pressure than any other type of portrait that I paint. But I also enjoy the challenge of it. It's good, again, to just, you know, test yourself and keep trying to improve in areas that you don't feel so confident in.
Yeah, definitely. Now I feel the same way because I was commissioned by my mother-in-law to draw my father-in-law for his birthday. And, so it was the pressure of one, drawing someone that you see very often, and so your memory tries to take over. And then two, like making sure it's good enough so every time you go over to their house, you're still happy with it and you're not wanting to be like, oh, I should
Yeah,
change that bit.
exactly. Because most of the time we send them off to their new homes, and that's the last we ever see of them. So while you want to be really sure that you've got it good and that you're happy with it, you don't have to look at it again if you don't want to. So yeah, when it's within the family, I think this is just a tiny bit of extra pressure.
Yeah, definitely. So, for artists who understand the basics but want to push into more advanced skills, what should they work on first?
Well, I've been talking about it a lot during this, and I think color theory is my biggest answer for this. There are a lot of other things that you would want to have a pretty strong basis in, like whether you grid something out or whether you trace or any of that. It's still important to be pretty strong with the draftsmanship, with the drawing skills, because this feeds into every part of the detail that you add later on as well. So there are many basics that it's good to, even if you are more advanced, to go back and revisit. But I think color theory is always going to be the thing for me that just keeps on opening up more things. And I've also already mentioned it a little bit, but tonal value. This is something that it's worth, even if you feel pretty good at this, to go back and check yourself, to go and do a little tonal value study of something and see how accurate you are with your tonal values. I did that recently. I made a video about all about tonal values, trying something first in grayscale and then seeing if that helped with the color version later on. And I even feel like, even though that was in the last 6 months, that my own use of tonal values has improved a little bit since doing that study. And I already felt like I was, pretty accurate with my tonal values. So I think even when you are more advanced, these basics are always worth revisiting and just honing your skills more, because before you know more, it's actually quite hard to assess what it is you need to work on. When you don't know very much, it's hard to say to yourself, well, that's what's lacking, that's what I need to improve on. Whereas later on, when you start to like really be able to critique your own work, it's at that point that you're able to say, well, that could be better, and even if it's something very basic, something you feel you should already be good at, it's always worth revisiting and just doing some little simple exercises or something like that, something that really makes you hone in on that skill. So yeah, perhaps my answer here is tonal value. Maybe that's the one, because I feel like it's the strong basis of any good painting or drawing.
It definitely makes the most difference, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it's really it's the strong foundation. It's what everything else is then built on top of. If you've got the tonal values, you can push color choices in wacky directions if you want. You can be like super saturated with your color choices, but you'll find that most artists who do that, their tonal values are still in there. They're still accurately describing the thing using tonal value. So yeah, I think it's probably my number one thing to say to anyone to go and look at again.
Yeah, definitely. So, do you have like a specific piece that's your favorite or one that's like pushed your boundaries and really pushed you out of your comfort zone as an artist?
Well, I have some favorites that will remain with me. They won't ever be for sale. And I think partly it's because of their subject matter. It's some of the portraits of my own animals. Certainly some of the portraits of my little dachshund who passed away a couple of years ago. There's some of the pieces that I did of her. She was such a fantastic muse. And I feel like I did some of my best paintings of her. So Yeah, it's more like when it's a personal thing, I think, rather than when I look at this painting, I feel like it's my best painting. I think it's just that it's my favorite painting, maybe, you know. And as art often is, it's to do with your connection to it. And I think that's what's so lovely about painting portraits for people, especially the animal portraits, because I don't think I've ever sold a landscape painting that reduced a person to tears when they saw it. Or, you know, there's such a strong connection with commissioned portraits. And I think that's been a really special area of my work, and I'm sure your work too over the years. You get such a strong connection with your client and usually such a strong reaction from them as well. So yeah, I think probably my favorite paintings of my own are for reasons like this, more than I feel like I technically painted something really well. You know, it's more to do with the connection with that piece, perhaps.
Yeah, I personally love those drawings as well of your Dachshund because I think that's probably what blew up your social media at the time as well, is when you drew those beautiful drawings of her. I can't quite remember, there's like the wooden floor and the table or something. Yeah, it's just such a beautiful piece. The reflections, the colours, the I like that it's like not focused on her, but she is the main thing. Like the composition was just so clever. Like I really love the way you did those.
Oh, thank you. You just described the one that I'm describing, because this is the one. I
Okay.
actually have this one framed and in my living room. So this is probably the one that I will keep this one with me. And not only because of memories of the dog in this, but also the place. You know, it was a lovely home that we had at this stage in Belfast. And the way the light used to come into this particular room was what I took so many photographs in this one room, and I painted quite a few of them. And then this painting was done years after, like we'd been away from that house for many years. And it was an image that I revisited, and I felt like I tackled that one with more knowledge than the earlier attempts. So I had more of my ideas from color theory and all of that. So I felt like that piece was one that I did for me to capture a really special memory, and at the same time to like throw everything that I'd learned, you know, like everything went into this piece. So I think when you get that combination where you've got the technical skills, you put everything into it from that angle, but then also emotionally, you've put everything into it from that angle too. And I think that's when you end up with like a special painting, one that you feel stands out. So yeah, I think these are often the best paintings from lots of artists, aren't they? Ones that have a lot of backstory as well as a lot of technical ability.
Yeah, it's definitely my favorite one of yours.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So you teach your art through Patreon and your YouTube channel. What is your style of teaching, and what do you want students to get from your lessons?
Well, I do like the sort of step-by-step tutorials. So I film everything basically. So I don't cut anything out, and you can basically watch and listen to the entire process from beginning to start to the end. I also pop up like color codes as I'm working. So a lot of the time, as I mentioned earlier, my pastel tray will look like varying shades of brown because they're all dirty. So it's very difficult sometimes to see exactly what color I'm using. So part of my method is to show you exactly what color I am using. But at the same time, I think the aim of my tutorials, although it's to take you step by step and really show you every single part of my process, my aim is to get people painting their own things, you know, to not get stuck in the world of tutorials. So I talk a lot about the photo references that I work from, because I'm not a professional photographer. So any photographs that I take, they're never perfect, and I'm having to apply a lot of theory or artistic license to try and pull out the painting that I can see in there. And I think this is also quite useful for people when they're learning, because a lot of the time the feeling is that you need this very high quality professional photograph to work from. And it's great that we have such access to a world of fantastic photographs online, and we can make use of, obviously with permission, we can make use of other photographers' talents. But a big thing that I encourage with my students is to look at your own material too, you know, really try to, and I think this links to what we were just talking about, try to, you know, get some emotional content in your painting as well, because if you're always painting other people's images, perhaps you're missing out on some magical things that you could be creating from your own memory bank, from your own, maybe you've got some snaps on your phone, or, you know, I really try to encourage people to bring out their own artistic qualities rather than just always copying or working along with someone, because this is great to be able to do that. And I think for some artists who don't want to go any further than that, that's absolutely fine. And you can have a great time working along with and, you know, producing things that turn out really well because you've got that guidance all the way through. But yeah, definitely one of the things that I try to encourage is to bring out your own, you know, your own creative inspirations or motivations, and to give people the tools really to, you know, if you want, you can go and take an image of your own and, you know, bring something magical out of it. So yeah, I think that's one of the main aims of mine, to give you the guidance, but to leave you with the tools that you can apply that stuff to your own work if you choose.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. I agree. That's so wonderful. Well, I think that's all we have time for. So, David, thank you so much for being here, and I've learned so much, and you're honestly so inspiring. I really want to, like, get my pastels out and, like, try a few things that you've been talking about.
Oh, I hope so. I hope that you do. And yeah, thank you so much for having me as well, and for making these videos as well, because I'm not sure that people always completely understand how much work and how much effort goes into what you're doing here, and giving people a platform to share their information. And so doing all of this on top of being an actual artist, you know, that's impressive too. So yeah, thank you for doing this style of interview and sharing other people's art with the world as well.
Oh, thank you so much. So to find more about Emma or try one of her tutorials, you can visit emmacolbertart.com and subscribe to her channel on YouTube, and I'll put all of the links in the description below. So for coloured pencil tutorials and monthly drawing challenges, you can also join me at learnmycraft.com. So thank you so much, Emma, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Practice makes perfect. Learn Minecraft.